Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. It is actually sunny outside. The weather is beautiful up here.
Yes, it is.
And we're going to have an unbelievable fun time show. And
I
see that the lady that is in charge and runs the World of Ink, Marcia Castle Cook, is here. She's listening. I hear her. I could see her phone number right there. And I have the author of an unusual case mystery that you're just going to absolutely love. His main character has two first names, as many people do, but this is really quite unique. The Case of the Purloined Painting, and the title, Shawn Mystery. Well, author Carl Brookins is here, and he's going to tell us just a drop more, but we're not going to give away a lot, because then you won't miss the fun of reading this. It's hilarious. At least I think so. I thought it was great. So,
well,
hi, Carl.
You.
How you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing?
Okay. So, before I even ask about this book, how did you create this guy's name? Why Shawn?
Oh, well, that's a very interesting question, and I don't have an answer for.
Oh, good.
The fact is, I really don't know. It took me a while to figure out where the character came from. Now, I know where the character came from, but the name just kind of appeared, and then I attached all these things to it so I can tell you the story. See, he's not exactly an orphan, but his mother was very remote. He never met his father. His mother said that his father was away at sea all the time, and Sean doesn't really know that. He would ask his mother if they were Irish, and his mother would say no. Sean is spelled S-E-A-N, and she said, no, you're not Irish. You're English and German and a lot of other things, but you're not Irish. And he has no middle initial. So those of you listening who know about government forms know that there's always a place to put a middle initial in. And if you don't have anything, in order to fill in the blank, you put in NMI. So Sean's full name is Sean, NMI, Sean. And his math teacher in high school used to say, it doesn't mean no middle initial. It means no measurable intelligence. So over time we worked out a number of quips and jokes and things about he's a very because he's short he has a certain amount of attitude, and he does certain sort of odd things that you won't get all of that out of. You'd have to read the whole series, which of course is a pitch for reading the whole series. but Mr. Sean is short. That's why he's not a cop. His lifelong ambition, he told me, was to be a cop, but he's not a cop. So he's a PI, and he has a lot of rules. He doesn't deal with the mob because they have a lot more people with guns and bad guys than I have. Maybe I can start this way. Sean came to me as the antithesis, as the opposite of the kind of PI novels I was reading as a horny teenager. Okay? And that was a long time ago, in the previous century. So my favorite PI was named Shel Scott. It was written by a man named Richard Prather, and Shel Scott was 6'6". He was a former Marine. His hair turned white when he was on Guadalcanal during World War II. And he's very quick with a gun. He shoots first and asks questions later. He said it's always easier to apologize to a dead guy. And he to put it delicately, he sleeps with any woman that he likes.
That's cool.
So I really, that for a 17-year-old, that sounded like a really good kind of life. And he lived in L.A. But when you read the books, and at one point he had 40 billion, with a B, books in print, this guy, that's how popular his books were. His books are satires. He was riffing on the PI genre, and he was poking fun at the authors and at the characters. And the books can be both read at a very serious, almost quite a violent level, or they can be read at a very funny satirical level. So I wanted a guy that would be the antithesis of that. So instead of 6 foot tall, he's only 5'2". He's very adept with weapons, but he never shoots if he doesn't have to. And his weapon of choice when he needs it is a 1911 Colt 45 automatic, which is a great huge semi-automatic. And as you said, when I shoot it, the recoil hurts my elbow. And he doesn't like to have to buy bullets. And so he doesn't use a weapon except in extremis, except at the very, as a last resort. But he'd rather run away and figure out a way to get the guy intellectually, you see. And he's very good at that. As he sometimes says when he's sitting in his office on Central Avenue looking out the window, you know, I'm a really good PI. And he is. He's an excellent PI. He's very bright. And the other things about Sean are that he has odd idiosyncrasies. Like a lot of short people do, his favorite shoe to wear is a Converse tennis shoe, and when he learned that Converse was not going to make that model anymore, he ran right out and bought 700 pairs so he didn't have enough to last his lifetime. You see, and they're red with white soles. But of course, you can't wear them when he goes undercover. The other thing about Sean is that he's not promiscuous. He's not married, but he's in love with and lives part of the time with his lover. His lover is a wealthy massage therapist who has contracts and who moves among the upper classes of Twin Cities society. And she's 6'2" in her stocking feet. So you can imagine what they're like walking down the street holding hands. And you know, they have a great time. So this is the context. And when I began to write the detective series, I went to a local shopping mall, and I borrowed a desk chair, you know, with wheels on it, and I spent 2 hours sitting in it, rolling about the mall, because I wanted to get a short person's perspective on what it was like to be in, you know, in crowds and what's it like to just be in ordinary society. Because I at the time, at least, I was 6'1", and I didn't know what that was like. So that gave me a real
perspective. You should have called me. I'm 5 feet.
I should have. See, I didn't know you that.
I'm little.
But that's how he came about. And I discovered later in thinking about him that he has a lot of the same characteristics as my roommate when I lived in Washington, D.C., and that was in the service. A buddy of mine, a man I met actually in the service, who was also in the Navy, we had an apartment because they couldn't accommodate us on the base. And he was only 5'2". So I used, as it turns out, I used a lot of his attitudes and idiosyncrasies. And that's how this guy came about.
Well, he's a cool guy. He's different. So this guy walks into his office and hands him a whole bunch of Benjamin Franklins, which a lot of people would love, to find this missing lady that he's supposed to meet. But each time they were to have their special encounter, she would be there, except this one time when she didn't show up. So why did he pay him money to find her?
Well, because when you read the book, you discover that he's a foreign agent. And he's in a town that he doesn't know, and he's, in effect, backup for another foreign agent. The foreign agent is this woman. And he says, being a smart guy, if I want to be sure that backup, not her backup, but that her, you know, that she's covered, that she's not, that nobody's going to find her and penetrate her. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make believe she's missing, and I'm going to hire the best private eye that I can find in the Twin Cities to see if he can find her. And who is that private eye? Oh, Sean, of course. So that's what he's doing. He's trying to see whether this detective can penetrate her cover.
So then somebody by the name of Ann walks into his office. I have my questions and my book review in front of me, so I want to get this, maybe I got it right. Ann walks in, enters his office, and she wants him to find a man named Manfred Gopley because she said he was pushed off a bridge and killed. And she said she thinks she witnessed the murder, but did she really do it? Witness it.
She did. She did, right? First scene, she, in the snowstorm, she saw him get shoved off the bridge. That's right.
That's true. See, I got this right.
Yeah, see, and she wants the notebook that he had, but she wants him, because she's a moral person, she wants his killers brought to justice. So she hires the same PI, to intercede with the cops to try to help put these guys away. And so that's the story. It's a two-thread story, and between the two of them. And you see, in mystery fiction, there's one unwritten rule that you can have one huge coincidence. And the huge coincidence is that she's on the bridge when Manfred Gottlieb gets murdered, and she picks up the notebook that the murderers were really looking for.
And
so that's the basis.
Puts herself in danger, so she finds that so enough. But then it goes back to Gottlieb's grandson, the grandson
right.
of the man who was killed, and
right.
two separate cases. So
right.
everybody wants this other thing, and how does it lead to a painting from World War II?
Well, the painting, of course, is the MacGuffin. The painting happens to belong to the guy who had the notebooks, who happened to come to Minneapolis after he got released from a death camp at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that's all the basis on which the story, the book itself, came about. Because I had read a book called The Monuments Men, right, which is about this unit in World War II that went around and protected important paintings and cathedrals and statuary and things like that, and helped when we invaded, when the Allies swept across Europe to throw the Nazis out. And then they went to find all the stolen artwork, you see. Okay, so that's what happened in World War II. We had this army unit that was dedicated to finding all of that artwork. And in fact, they're still doing that. Now, in 2003, however, when the U.S. Army went into Baghdad and lawlessness came about, the Army stood around while several museums in Baghdad were looted. And when they asked why they ignored it, they said, well, we didn't have any orders.
Hmm.
In the contrast, that really made me mad. All those priceless artifacts that had been collected and were in the Baghdad Museum were being stolen and were being taken away. Many of them disappeared and have never been found, and many of them will be destroyed. All right, so I got really angry, and I thought, well, I'm going to write a book in which I explore that. So the painting becomes one of the motivating factors for all these people getting together in Minneapolis. Because
now we have this. Go on.
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
No, it's okay. This painting is like an, you know, everybody
it's just a
wants
painting.
It.
Yeah, it's an ordinary little painting, but it becomes the collateral for a loan, and the loan makes the guy who brings it back without thinking about the implications of the fact that he's stolen this painting that belonged to somebody. The painting comes back, the painting becomes collateral, the company becomes bigger and bigger, builds a bigger and bigger factory. Now they want to give the painting back to the descendants of the man who owned it originally, not knowing that the man who owned it is the subject of a murder investigation. You see, so it all ties together at the end.
This is like so crazy. I know. It
is? Yeah.
I know.
It's kind of crazy.
But Sean gets into some fixes too. Because
oh, yeah.
His girlfriend is computer savvy. That would be Catherine.
That's
and
right.
They try to take him out. And
right.
I guess they don't want him to find out. The fun part is when they hack into machines and computers. I love that. I always wanted to learn how to do that. I've got to have Sean's girlfriend show me how to do that.
Yeah, that's right.
So
you can
get the information you want.
He has a friend who does serious deep diving when that's necessary. He has a couple friends who can do the kind of hacking that he needs. And that's a couple I created in an earlier book, of the Revlon sisters, who have an office down the hall from him. And their ongoing role in the series is when Sean really needs some research done, and he needs it done online, and he needs it done in such a way that nobody can trace it to him, he goes to these two sisters, and they take care of things for him. So it's part of his gang. You know, he doesn't have, unlike Dennis Lehane, who has a detective Gennaro, who has a really bad guy who kills people for them. Which is an interesting. It's like the Myron Bolitar series by Harlan Coben.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that.
You know, he has a bad guy, a really wealthy bad guy who has absolutely no compunctions about killing bad people. I mean, he's always killing bad people, but he is a killer, and it leaves the detective hands clean. And that's a perfectly legitimate scene. I don't do that because I want Sean to be more actively and more directly involved in the kinds of activities, because there are scenes in my books in which he agonizes over the fact that he's had to hurt somebody or had to kill somebody, even though he's doing it for all the right reasons. Still,
well, he's got flaws. He's not perfect. He's got a heart, and most PIs that you see on television really don't. They just and most of the books I've read, all about 4,000 of them by now, in the whatever. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, there are different types of PIs, and some of them have heart, and some of them are cold-blooded killers, and some of them, don't exactly, get the guy. I often wonder, even when I've read, and I haven't read in a while, James Patterson's Alex Cross, and he's supposed to be a great psychologist and, police officer, and he gets caught too many times, and sometimes I actually think he doesn't make him too smart. So and that bothers me because he's supposedly a smart man, and
you wonder why he gets caught.
He gets caught, or he doesn't get the case.
So, and that happens. But one of the things that does is it makes the character a little more human.
Yeah.
You don't want this character. You don't want this detective to be perfect. On the other hand, that's one of the problems you run into. Ask Sue Grafton. That's one of the problems you run into when you write a long-running series, because it gets more and more difficult as time goes on to make things fresh and different, and your character can only have so many, so many characteristics and dimensions and things, and it can get to be very difficult to maintain that level of interest. And in today's marketing, the way things go, if you don't maintain the level of interest on the part of your editor, they'll release you very quickly.
Well, that's the truth, because a lot of books in the series, after a while, and I read so many, the character is good, and after a while you feel like, it's just this, another book, another situation, another murder, nothing special. And after a while, even though it might be a New York Times bestselling author, and the first five books might be, five stars, the next one might be four. Because after a while, it becomes mundane in the same thing that they've written before. But it seems like with this guy, you could do an awful lot.
I have tried to build into him, thank you for saying that, I have tried to build into him enough idiosyncrasies so I will always have something fresh to deal with, and we don't have to deal with all those things at the same time. And he has, the other thing, of course, you can do is you can bring in other characters who are interesting and unusual. And Sean is interested in a lot, in people, in a lot of different ways. And, of course, he has this very interesting lover, Catherine McKerney, who has this massage school and all these massage contracts. So she comes into contact with a whole bunch of people. And finally, the Twin Cities is a fairly small city and has not a lot of boroughs like New York, but it has a lot of suburbs. And there are probably 20 or 30 different police agencies all within, say, 15 miles. And so Sean, instead of being an anti-cop, he gets along with the cops really well, because he knows there are some things they have resources that he doesn't have. They can do things that he can't do. And in return, he can go places and do things that are at least a little bit illegal that the cops wouldn't dare do, because if they get caught, it would be, it would be a big ethical problem. But he can do things for the cops just as they can do things for him. So he has contacts in 25 or 30 different law enforcement agencies around the Twin Cities. And, of course, it drives him crazy remembering who belongs to what.
I would imagine. But you can awfully do a lot. I mean, each person that runs each police agency is different. each has
right.
their own way of handling things, so you can actually have him handle cases just about, like you said, just about anywhere for the
exactly.
next 20 or 30. So why did one person want to find a specific woman, and who was Robert Goetz? And
Robert
how
Goetz.
Would
Robert Goetz.
And how would he
right.
how would he contact him? Because he couldn't contact anybody. That's, like, weird.
Well, Robert Goetz is a foreign agent. He comes to, and we never do learn exactly which country employs him, but
yeah.
he comes to the Twin Cities with his co-agent, with his fellow agent, who's a woman, whose name may or may not be Anne, and he comes to town to try to get his hands on a notebook. The notebook has specific information in it about some very powerful people who were Nazi collaborators during World War II. And that's why he wants it, and that's why the people who murdered Gottfried want it. The same reason. They want to destroy it. He wants to take it back to some law enforcement agency in Europe. All right. So Robert Goetz comes to town, and he's concerned about his cover and about the protection of the cover for his fellow agent, Anne.
Anne.
She never spelled her name for it, Sean, so he doesn't know how to spell her first name. So he says, being a very clever agent, Robert Goetz says, I will see if we can penetrate your cover. I will hire somebody to try to find you. And he does a little research, and he says, who's the cleverest, most reliable private investigator in the Twin Cities? And the name that comes up, of course, is Sean. So he goes to Sean and sets him up. He said, okay, I've been seeing this woman, and here's all the particulars about her, and here's a picture of her, which, of course, is not a real picture of the real Anne. It's just a picture of a woman. And I want you to find her for me. And Sean says, okay, here's the fee. And he says, so he goes off to do it. And, of course, he does find her, but as he goes along, because of the information he both gets and doesn't get from Mr. Goetz, he comes to realize that she's the same woman that the reason he wants to find her is for reasons other than what he told Sean, and that there's something suspicious going on here. And so, and the more he works with Anne, who has the notebook, remember.
Mm-hmm.
The more he works
with
Anne, the more he realizes that she and the woman that Goetz is looking for are the same person, and they're trying to run a con on him. So instead of blowing it off and saying, you guys are running a con on me, and I know this is all phony, he decides to use that information to help him find out, solve the real problem that he's working on, which is to satisfy the nephew of the murdered man, Manfred Gottfried, and bring to justice the people who killed him.
Now, there's a few other people that are involved in this, and the third person that's very interesting was Daryl Madison. So he calls on him, and he wants to meet with him in private.
The lawyer.
Mm-hmm. The lawyer,
yeah. That's the lawyer in the wheelchair. That's a complete invention. I don't know where that came from, but I do know that there are agencies out there that are interested in helping repatriate stolen artworks and other things. You know, World War II, the Nazis went into some homes and peeled the wallpaper off the walls and stole it.
I just finished a book like that, as a matter of fact.
Can't imagine why they did that, but they did. You know, I mean, they were obsessed with these kinds of things. And it's a fascinating story. And the fact is, of course, that there's a lot of that artwork that is still missing. They haven't found it. And when they do find it, figuring out who it belongs to is also an interesting problem. So that whole business is an ongoing mystery that people are exploring. And I find that really kind of interesting because all that kind of smuggling and all that sort of thing that went on during and right at the end of the war there was a whole period of lawlessness that nobody had a real handle on. Same thing was true in the West, to change the subject slightly, but my next Sean is set on the West Coast, and it's about a small island 600 miles west of Tokyo where a U.S. flyer was killed while he was smuggling diamonds.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of that went on. And so, and I'm not going to tell you how that relates to what's going on in Twin Cities, but it does.
I'm sure it does, and I'm sure I'm going to get the book, because if I know your publicist, you're just going to automatically mail it to me, which is what most people do anyway, because I never know. The doorbell rings, and I go, I'm hiding from you. Don't send me any more books. Yeah, there's a pile in the drawer that I know I'm not going to read because they're the books I didn't ask for, and they're not what I really want to read because I don't, enough self-help and whatever. Then there's the group on my dresser that's, they're moving up sort of. And then there's the group in the living room, like those 10 that I've already started, all 10 at once. But I just finished Voices from the Other Side by Jean Goodwin, Messenger. And it was stories of people that lived through World War II. And they told exactly that. Yeah, one story is about how...
Are you interested in that area? Interested in stories like that? You should read A Train in Winter. A Train in Winter. It's about... The roundup in Paris by the Nazis of women who were in the resistance movement.
That sounds interesting. My grandmother was in the concentration camp in Poland. She never... It was funny because my mother said... I heard... you ever hear, conversations, but you're not supposed to hear them?
Yeah,
they're talking and you're not supposed to know. So my grandmother said something one day and they were talking and I heard my aunt say something and I didn't realize until after she died that this conversation was because she was not really my mother's mother. She was my grandmother's real sister. But nobody said anything that she never had children. And she once said, I never had children on my own, but I have these 5 children. And, a kid of 10 and 11, it doesn't dawn on you what happened. And I just said to her, what are you talking about? And I found out later on she was in a Polish concentration camp and they did experiments on her, which were kind of horrible. She couldn't see, she had cataracts. But when my grandmother died, when my mom was 2, my grandfather had several choices, and thank God he picked the right one. She had a couple of sisters, my grandmother, real grandmother. And my grandfather said 3 months later he had 5 children, and he decided to marry one of the sisters. And like I said, fortunately he picked the right one, because my grandmother was she was amazing. She was amazing with 5 kids, and the kitchen was hers, and it was she just withstood everything. She never said anything. And then one day she just sat down and told me about it, and I never told anybody.
You're going to want to read this book. The author, I just found it and pulled it off the shelf. The author is Caroline Moorehead. It's Moorehead. She's a famous British biographer. A Train in Winter. It's an absolutely very moving about the way the women created the resistance in France and what happened to them.
Interviews. What? Kate Moss just wrote one, and I did review it, Citadel, which is exactly about the resistance in France. Mm-hmm. Except that the book was, it was good. The book was almost 700 pages, though. It was very, very long.
This book is a lot shorter than that. This is only about 250 pages.
I can handle that.
I think you'd enjoy this. This is really something good here.
Mm. So, well, we've got little Sean Chuan, and he's becomes a target. And he's got a detective friend, Ricardo, that warns him. So, and then we have Ursula, who's living in Manfred's house for whatever reason. She's there. And so why do they want to kill poor Sean?
Well, because he's interfering and because he's learning too much and they're afraid that he's going to spill the beans to the wrong people. So he becomes a target.
Well,
he's in the way.
That's like Magnum or Rockford or something. They're always in the way.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. I know. So who was Murchison, and how did this powerful man play an important part? And then Sean decides to go to Poland. Why?
No. Sean never goes to Poland. He would
never
leave
the country.
No, he could barely make it to the Wisconsin border. He doesn't travel. He doesn't like crops. He doesn't like looking at the grain blowing in the field. He's not into that at all. No, he's very much an urban guy.
Sounds like me. I hate flying too, but what can I do?
Well, Murchison is the name of the GI who stole the painting originally in Poland and brought it home. See, that's the whole thing there. That's how the painting got to Minneapolis.
Mm.
And then the Murchisons became very powerful. Big. They became a wealthy family in the Twin Cities based on the money they borrowed using the painting as collateral.
Well, we don't want to give away too much about what happens next and whether he finds the painting or not. But World War II, like you said, is a really interesting time period. But what did this
painting very fertile time period. That's right.
Yeah. What did this painting look like that everybody wanted it?
Oh, it's a pastoral painting of the Bug River.
It shows
a river. No, it's spelled B-U-G and it's pronounced Bug. It's a Polish river. It's an actual painting by an actual Polish author. Painter.
Mm-hmm.
Artist.
That's interesting.
It's not a big, important painting. Okay? It's not very large. And he didn't get a lot of money for it. But he got enough, you know. So it works okay. It's a device.
Mm. So... What research? You had to do a lot of research to do this book, right?
I did, but I like doing research. Yeah, I did. I spent a lot of time online, and I spent a lot of time at the library. I go to our local library a lot. I like libraries. They have books there.
Okay. You see, I go to the library, too, to watch my husband suffer and take them out because I don't have to do that anymore because people just send them to me. And every so often I look and I go, oh, gee, I would love to read that, but it's not on my list of who sent it. I mean, my husband's happy because I've saved him thousands of dollars in buying books because I don't have to do that anymore. But every so often, you know, you want to sit down and say, okay, I want to read something, but I don't want to have – when I read and I review a book, I have a pen in my hand, and I have the book in my hand, and then I circle. I won't read PDF or Kindle or Nook ever. I'll only read a real book. And I have to take notes in the margin, and then I pray that I remembered what I read, and then I misplace the book, and then go, oh, God, where's the book? I have to write the review because I want to make sure that I have all the events right.
Sure.
No, I had a close encounter with one this morning. I'm saying, oh, my God, I had to post a review for Partners in Crime, which is a group that promotes books. And I'm saying, what did I do with the review of The Corpse That Walked Through the Door? I had to write it over. I couldn't find what I tagged it as. And this guy that works, he must get up at 2 o'clock in the morning because when I posted the thing at 6, he thanked me 5 after 6 for doing it. But like, don't you ever sleep? I mean, I got up and said, oh, my God, what happened to this thing? I don't know. But Sean is very persistent.
And yes,
he doesn't give up. So you have to like him. But when he gets hurt, you want to punch the guy in the head that did it. You don't like that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you said that. I want you to like this guy and defend him. You know, he's a little guy. Sometimes he needs help. So this is very true.
You know, but I'm little, but I'm tough, and I have a big mouth. And well, my husband's doctor found that out last week because he got me annoyed, which is a bad mistake. It was like first impressions. I don't like you. I had the mistake of asking a simple question, and he said something. I said, I do get what you're saying, but your rudeness really doesn't preclude, you know, you having to answer me that way. I said, I asked a simple question, and if the answer is you can't accommodate what I'm saying, I get what you mean. But he said, why are we having this conversation? I said, why are you bothering? I said, why are you operating on my husband? I said, I don't trust you now. So he sort of backed off, and... I just don't like him. So asked to have his x-ray sent to somebody, and it was just hilarious because he called my cell phone because my husband won't give out his phone, which is good. So he has to deal with the big mouth over here. And he gets on the phone, and he says to me, I called to see how he's doing. I said, he doesn't listen. He goes to work, blah, blah, blah. I said, by the way, did you send the x-rays to? And I tell him who. And he got quiet. He said, why are you sending it to this particular oral surgeon? I said, because he's my cousin and he's the top in the world. And he happens to have been his teacher and his professor.
Oh.
So his whole,
world,
it was
right?
Hilarious. His whole attitude changed. Oh, my God, how's he doing? I go, I'll pass your message on. Don't worry. And I had called my cousin the day before. I said, this man's horrible. And he said, but I rethought about it. He says, oh, you poor thing. But, yeah, it's perception. So,
yeah.
I mean, just because Sean is short doesn't mean that he's not strong and powerful in his own way.
Right.
So,
that's exactly right. And he has attitude, which a lot of short people do.
Yeah,
and I can understand why. Just spending a whole afternoon in a crowd sitting on a chair, I can understand that. I saw a lot of belt buckles I never would have seen before.
Yeah, you do. You have to have an attitude. Well, I taught for all these years, and I walk into a classroom, and I'm little, and the kids are 9 feet tall, taller than me, and they would go, and they didn't start with me, And, the chick is having, three cell phones, one for the mother's phone number, one for the father, and one in case if you run out of battery. Seriously. And I was the dean. So they didn't mess with the little short person, and they knew it. It was just the way you say things that, gets your message across. And basically I learned that you basically don't have to raise your voice. It's all in your tone that works.
That's right. Attitude.
So
makes a big difference.
What would you say Sean's major attributes are? What would be some adjectives that describe this guy?
He's a white knight. He likes to help people. He's bright. Not so much with formal education as he is with intuition. And he's really good at reading people. Those are not one word I understand, but
then he has to have been born in September like me because I'm very perceptive.
Well, that could be. I never really thought about when his birthday is.
I could write a story
about his birthday, couldn't I?
If he's a Virgo like me and born in September, my birthday was last week when my husband wound up in the surgeon's office. Yep, he wound up in the surgeon's office thing. And if he's like a Virgo and whatever, then he's persistent. He's a perfectionist. He does have a heart. He doesn't like to hurt people, but if you come at him, he's going to destroy you.
Right.
That's Sean in a nutshell. That's me in a nutshell. That's why. Yeah. You don't mess with us Virgos.
I'll have to bring him to New York and introduce him to you. You'd like him.
This is true. You should just put me in your next book. Sean meets Fran.
There you go,
So why does Catherine, this tall person, this massage therapist, why does she have a thing for Sean? If somebody asked her that question, what would you say?
We just talked about that.
Yeah. Well, she's just so different, though. Are you going to put her in the next one and make her, help more?
I tend to write very strong women because I grew up in a household of very strong women, and she will be, and there are one of the earlier books. She has an even bigger role, but she will continue to have a very important place in Sean's life and roles. And while he's very protective of her, he knows that she can protect herself when necessary. So they will become more of a partnership.
That's good. That is good. Yeah. So who is Ursula, and why is she living in that in Gottlieb's house? What is with her?
Ursula is a graduate student who needed a place to live, so she rented a room in Gottlieb's house. That's all.
Oh, well, you said I thought maybe she was going to be a little sinister. I don't know why.
No, I don't believe so. I don't think so.
So what is this ledger that everybody wants? Why does everybody want it?
Well, they want it because it identifies objects that were stolen by the Nazis during their occupation, and it identifies, in this case, it identifies some of the people who were involved in the theft. Now, if you want to see what those ledgers look, see, the Germans were very meticulous, and they kept records of all these things all over Europe, and most of those notebooks survived, and you can see pictures of them on the internet.
Oh, that is interesting.
And this one happens to be one that, that was sent to St. Paul or to Minneapolis, which is an anomaly, which doesn't usually happen. But this is a case of in which the book has information in it, not just a listing of things that were stolen from the small community in Poland, but that it also lists some of the previous owners, and there are some important names in it. And that's why these three murderers come to town to try to retrieve it so they can destroy it and to kill Manfred Gottlieb in the process.
Not very nice.
So while they are successful at killing the refugee, the Jewish worker Manfred Gottlieb, they are not successful at bringing the notebook back to their employers, and so eventually justice is realized. You know, but there's fallout. There are always unintended consequences for these things.
This is very true.
See, I have an acquaintance from years ago whose father brought back a saber from one of the Pacific Islands that belonged to a Japanese general, and he should not have brought it back. But it's that was a very common thing. People brought back stuff like that, and it was later used in a murder of a family member. Now, if he hadn't brought that back, the murder might have happened anyway. But it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that this guy goes through World War II unscathed, brings back a sword, which is then used to kill a family member. See?
What goes
around sometimes comes around. Yeah?
This is very true. But I'm not going to bring out any too many more characters in this book before we give away too
much. Well, there
aren't
too many more, I don't think.
No, there's Lucy, and then there's the
yeah.
So Sean is unorthodox,
yes.
When you're writing your next one, what kind of wild situations will you put him in?
Well, for one thing, he has to go to Des Moines.
That's not very exciting.
It's pretty exciting. He doesn't want to go to Des Moines. He doesn't want to go to the That's right. And he doesn't want to go to the Pacific. I don't know how bizarre I don't think of these things as particularly bizarre. I guess they are somewhat unusual. Mm-hmm. But he gets attacked by people in a number of interesting ways, I guess is what I would say.
But what would happen if you decided one day that you're in charge, not him? And you decided
is that right?
You were going to send him somewhere that you would like him to attempt to solve a case, but he doesn't want to go. Where would that be?
I don't know where that would be, but I can tell you what would happen.
He wouldn't
solve the case. Yeah, he wouldn't
solve the case.
That's
there ever been a case where he didn't solve it?
There is. Well, there's a short story that I haven't finished in which I think he'll solve it, but he hasn't yet. And he's not too happy about being there, and it's raining a lot. And it's a small town, and he doesn't want to be there.
Well, what about, I look at the end of chapters sometimes.
Yeah.
And some authors write at the end of the chapter, and then they start the next chapter, it just sort of fits in. And then some authors write, like I says, I drop the envelope in his lap, and we beat it out of there back to my office. And
right.
Then he goes into the car. It sort of blends in.
Yeah.
Each chapter sort of blends into the next one. How do you get it where when somebody is finished with the chapter and they want to turn the page and read more?
Well, well, you work on that. You think about what would you like to happen next? What do you want the reader to feel at this point?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to motivate that reader to turn the page, or do you want the reader to just stop and say, "I'll come back to this book tomorrow"? Because sometimes that can be important. Sometimes it's useful for the reader not to read through the whole blow through the whole thing. I've spent a year working on this book, and you're going to read it in 6 days, and then say, "Okay, that's good. Give me the next one. Give me a break."
I won't tell you how fast it is that I read your book. You see,
that's okay.
If I read your book and it takes me more than 2 hours to read it, and then to take notes and reread it, you're in big trouble. Then you're in big trouble, because if it takes me 3 days to read a mystery that's not long, then it's the mystery is, why am I finishing it?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think that's a legitimate point. Although what I hope is that readers will stop upon occasion, say at the end of a chapter, and think about what has just happened or what some of the characters have just said, and ponder how that might, if it were to happen in their lives, how it might happen. And I don't want to get too heavy. These things are not meant to be, these are not biblical texts or anything like that. These are, which is just history anyway. But these are meant to be entertainment, and they're supposed to entertain you. They're supposed to hold your attention, but they're not supposed to be books that require you to go off and do research or spend time pondering the inner, deeper, hidden, secret meaning of life and things like that. Now, a little of that is okay, and I like to put some of that at the end of a chapter, so you can say, "All right, well, I'll think about that some, and then I'll finish the book tomorrow," or things like that. See.
Well, there was the things about family trees and families that were destroyed in this book too, and a little bit in the history. But I usually, when I get a murder mystery, the bad part is if I figured out who did it after the first 3 pages. And that's happened.
Unless it's that
sometimes,
kind of book.
Sometimes I'm really that good. And sometimes I'll say, like, where is he going with this? I better read the next chapter.
There you go.
Well, when I start a book, it depends on if that's the doorbell bringing me more books I'm hiding. They bought 3 this morning at 8 o'clock, and it's like, don't bother. I'm not bending down to get more books. I don't even want to know you. It depends. I mean, there have been books that have been 400, 500 pages, and I've said, okay, my eyes get eye strained, so I'll read half today and half tomorrow.
Sure.
And then, of course, I have to take notes to make sure that I get it all straight, got it all straight. And then, of course, it would help if I reread what I wrote, because sometimes you never know what you're going to write.
Well, sure. And the fact is, it doesn't matter how fast you read something, you can miss things.
Well, I understand what I read. I don't miss anything. It's just that your book was easy to understand, but sometimes, you know, there are a whole bunch of mysteries, which brings me to one of my final questions. How many plots are too many? In other words,
in any book.
I mean, I've read, at least 1,500, maybe more mysteries, and there are plots where there's a main plot, and then there's the subplot, and then there's the sub-subplot, and then I'm sitting there with one of my graphic organizers from one of my sites, and I'm going, okay, wait a minute, I need to get a story plot graph.
Yeah.
And I'll put the main character and I'll go, okay, this character's going here, this one's going there, this going there. And sometimes you say to yourself, why are they doing this to me? Why do I have to know so many things? And how much do I want to include in the review? I think the other hard one is the book I read this morning, Voices from the Other Side. It's excellent. It's just that it's 24 short stories. And you can't...
That's 24 plots.
I gave an overview of what they were all about. The author thought I did a great job. I was impressed with me, too, today, because it was hard. And then I just picked out like 4 or 5 that I thought really hit home, that
I think everyone should read. Well, the answer to your question is that there is no finite number, but how many is too many when there's one more than you really want?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And sometimes
that's
it gets
it
to be
down.
Overpowering, too overpowering.
Well, yeah, and then you got too many.
And then how many pages are too many? I mean, I've read books that are 150 pages and 250, which is about good. And then I've got one that's about 1,000 pages, and I go like, I'm going to pile you on. You're going to, you know, those are the ones that come last.
Yeah. Well, the answer to the question is in my view, once you've told a story, then I think you should stop.
That's exactly it. So sometimes they drag it on.
That's what I do. No. No, it's just you stop. You say, I start at the beginning of the book, and I write the book, and when I get to the end of the story and I've said everything that needs to be said about this particular event or crime or whatever it is, then I stop, because you don't need to go into long, involved epilogues and things, and I don't like things like that, and I think that shows a lack of discipline. It's, you just have to learn to stop. And so the number of plots can be very flexible, and it's just, if it's more than you want to deal with, then it's too many.
Well, you made it easy for me, because it was 165 pages, and I just read it because I was laughing most of the time and saying, okay, this guy's a riot. And I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was just exactly right. And now I'm reading one that's a lot longer, about a young girl that decides to go to Siberia in Korea, and her whole life changes. And the book, it's not that the book isn't good. The book is very good. It's just that it's just too long.
Yeah,
and my other complaint sometimes is, these people that write books with small fonts, please do not write a book in 4 and 5 font. It makes
That's not the author's decision.
That's the publisher's decision.
That's the publisher's decision.
And it makes
decision.
It really,
that's a very
really
bad
hard
decision.
To read a book that's less than 14 font.
See, now if you had that as an e-book, you could just press a button and make the type bigger.
Yeah, but then it wouldn't have the fun of sitting on my chair and circling it and underlining it, and I would get eye strain. And then
you
know what happened?
My nephew had this project on some readers, you know. Now.
Yeah, my nephew had this project to do, and he asked me to help him, like I said, to read this book, and I sent away from Barnes & Noble. That was a mistake because it never got there. Got there like when the project was over. And I sent to Amazon on that Friday, and I got it on that Tuesday. And in between there, I said, okay, I'm going to do something insane. I tried to find a copy of the book online. The book wasn't considered a book. It was considered a textbook. And because of it, not one library in New York City carried it. I could not believe it. My library didn't carry it, and not one bookstore had it. Well, maybe the one in Timbuktu, but nothing in New York City. No one had it. And I found somebody actually downloaded, like, I think the first, there were 120 pages, like 17 chapters. They downloaded the first 14 or something. So I never download things on my phone. So I said, the heck with it, I'll read it on my phone. And in order to read this thing on my phone and enlarge it, it took me 4 days. Where when I got the book, it took me half
phone.
An hour.
I don't understand. I can't do that. I don't have a cell phone. I don't see any need for one. I have computers. So I want to read. I can
no,
read
I
on,
have the need for
all day
people,
long on my computer.
When people email me, when people email me, they expect answers like in a minute. And if my nephew or my niece need me, you know, I'm on homework patrol all the time.
Uh-huh.
And the 2 nights ago, I was on homework patrol at 10 o'clock when my nephew, who's 8, said, I need help with my math homework. I said, you should tell your father he should be doing this earlier. And then I helped him. And I was like, I know, I'm the homework patrol person.
Mitch.
You know, isn't that what ants do? So when is this next book coming out, and when am I getting it?
I don't know when you're getting it, but the next book is coming out probably next spring, I think.
Which would be like March or April, right?
Yeah, something like that.
I have to tell you people out there that my show is booked until December 23rd.
Ah,
all three
okay.
of them. And I'm going to have to get Carl back on when I do.
I'd be happy to come back on.
That would be cool. For Let's Write. Have you ever written, well, this book, you writing a short story, have you ever written a novella?
Oh, no, not really. This is about the shortest, other than a couple of short stories, this is the shortest thing I've written.
Well, that's all right, because we're going to have a show in January. Let me figure out the date, because I'm getting good at this now. January the 4th, Tuesday, is 1, 2, 3, 4, the 27th. And the topic of that's going to be writing novellas, novels versus short stories. What does it take to get your message across and whatever else comes to my brain?
Discipline, in one word.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one, because on the next show on Let's Write, the first show is October 28th. We're going to be talking about different settings and different plot lines for characters in a series and a whole lot more with a New York Times bestselling author. I know he's really big, and I'm not going to tell who it is. It's a secret. plus award-winning author and forensic psychiatrist Mark Rubenstein, who has dealt with the Boston bomber and people like that. Author of the Alexander Wainwright series, Mary Martin, who quoted me on the front cover of her book. So for that alone, she gets, an award. Yeah, her books are really good.
Right.
The second one, I will give away a little bit, Alan Topol and Stuart Yates, and the head author and creator of Murder, She Wrote, will be on November 25th. And we got the one and only Tess Gerrinson and Die Again. I'm going to talk about creating Rizzoli and Isles and strong women characters. And in January, we're going to talk about the novella, the short story, and the novel. So I'm going to put you down for that one.
You got a full plate there, kid.
That's true, because in between there, I've got my book discussion and the other one. Yeah, if I can survive this, it should be fun. Yep. So I want to thank you so much. Yeah, this has been fun, and these characters are interesting, and I can't wait to see if you bring in another love interest for poor Sean Schwann or another one for Catherine. You're not going to destroy them, because that would break my heart. That would be terrible.
No, I don't think I'll destroy either one of them. No, I think they're around for the duration. Well, this has been great fun. I appreciate
fun.
Talking to you, and we'll talk again.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much, Carl. Have a nice night.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye, friend.